Okay, good morning. Now, before we get started, just a couple of things. First is, you've probably gotten a message saying that from 12 to 1 in the Master's Lab today, the demonstrator will be available to talk to you about your assignments. So if you have any remaining questions or issues to deal with, you can go along at sort of the last hour of this time slot and talk to him in the Master's Lab. If you're a remote student and couldn't make it today, just please feel free to send an email and either try and deal with the problem in that way or arrange some other time to see him. The second is sort of a combination apology warning in advance. I've got a cough, which most of the time doesn't kick in, but when it does, is reasonably incapacitating. So apologies if it happens during the lecture. You can just amuse yourselves while I spend a few minutes hacking. And on Camtasia, just try and fast forward through it. But hopefully it won't kick in. Okay, so last time we were wrapping up our cellular networks discussion, and so GSM was our example of a 2G network, so a cellular network whose primary and pretty much only goal was to provide voice connectivity. Okay, and so then where'd you go beyond this? And, well, you go into packet handling and data services for cellular networks. And so the goal of 3G is to sort of handle packets properly and to offer high data rates to users. Okay. Yeah, naturally, network providers don't want to just sort of scrap one system and totally rebuild it for the next new thing. So this is typically accomplished as an evolutionary process. So you take your 2G network and you keep making modifications to it until it meets the 3G standards. Okay. And so this is accomplished from sort of whatever base point you're starting at, and that differs depending where you are in the world. For this part of the world, it's GSM. And the first sort of real advance from GSM is dedicated, the addition of dedicated packet handling. And this is accomplished in the GPRS / Edge networks. And essentially what they do is they add specific components mainly to the switching subsystem, which handle packets. Okay. Depending on sort of what clever technologies you're using, you can come pretty close to the 3G standards, although it's not sort of classed as 3G for a bunch of reasons. Okay. So 3G is characterized, again, by these sort of technical concerns of, sort of high data rates and packet handling, but also at a practical level by the spectrum allocation. So new portions of the radio spectrum were allocated for 3G services and 3G networks. And so what this meant was that you now have to change your radio equipment to accommodate the new spectra. And so from GPRS and Edge, the biggest change that UMTS introduces is the change now in the radio access, or the air interface, as they refer to it. Okay, so now your end user equipment is changing and your base station equipment has to change. Additionally, you have better handling of sort of multimedia data, and a media gateway node is added to the switching subsystem to sort of handle the multimedia type traffic, sort of different from other packet traffic and different from voice. Okay, and so that's the very high-level view. Obviously, it sweeps under the carpet a heck of a lot of details that we covered in the lecture, and even the lecture was sort of a very high-level view of sort of how these things were accomplished. Today, we're going to sort of change tack and look at both wireless LANs, primarily, well, totally 802.11, and Bluetooth. And both of these are sort of different from sort of the cellular comms networks in the sense that what they're really trying to provide is a point-to-point connection. Okay. So, in cellular networks, you had, obviously, that point-to-point connection was very important, and all the radio stuff was all about providing a point-to-point connection, but you also had to manage leading that connection back into a back-end network and a core network and managing end-to-end connectivity. Here, we're just concerned with the point-to-point connection, and you may or may not, depending on what sort of the network or application is, you may or may not lead on to that from that network to another point. Typically, if you're talking a local area network, you would have an access point which would get your packets out to, you know, let's consider it a wired network and, you know, the internet. So typically there is a back end, but the protocols themselves don't care about that. Okay. In Bluetooth, well, it depends what your application is. You may be transmitting your data so that it, again, gets transferred out ultimately to the internet, or you may just be having a couple of devices talking amongst themselves and just exchanging data amongst themselves and don't care about any wider world. But again, Bluetooth is just concerned with sort of getting data from point A to point B, maybe in an appropriate format. Okay. The references for both portions of this lecture are William Stallings again. And so he covers wireless LANs, 802.11 in Chapter 14, and then Bluetooth in Chapter 15. Okay, I think everybody's probably at this point pretty clear on why we like wireless. It's nice not to have a wire. It's nice not to, you know, to have your laptop sitting here and you can move it sort of from the couch to the dining room, to the bedroom, wherever, without having to sort of unplug, reconnect, whatever. Okay. It offers a fairly cost-efficient solution for connectivity. It's cheaper, again, to plop down an access point somewhere than to have to wire everything in and to wire sockets into sort of specific places. It's also more expandable for just that reason. You don't have to sort of add physical connections. You know, you just as the device is powered up, it can arrange its connectivity. And potentially, although this is not actually sort of common, but potentially you can sort of do away with the networking infrastructure altogether and just, again, have devices talking one to the other. Okay. And so this allows a convenient form of connectivity, and it can also provide connectivity in places that where it would be very difficult to wire things up. Okay, so outdoors, or again, just sort of open spaces, somewhere where people gather, and you don't want to have to plug in every time, but you can offer, if they have the laptop, they can bring it along and connect up. Okay. There is a price to be paid for this. And again, they said this is nothing new. This is true. These are the issues that arose in the wireless network, in the cellular networks as well. It's hard to get good data rates, and so it's certainly possible to get much higher data rates on wired networks, fast Ethernet, than it is on a wireless. You have security issues. Again, since it's a radio connection, anybody can pick up on that connection, and so you have to make sure that your data is in some way more difficult to decode. You also have to regulate the access to the network to, whoever you consider to be authorized to use the network. That might be everybody, but if it's a private network, then you have to have sort of authorization as well. Again, reliability gives you higher loss rates and not as good a quality connection. And there are sort of serious range limitations, so typically 20 to 50 meters. There are obviously range limitations with wired networks as well, but again, you can get much higher distances. Okay, so the dominant, excuse me, technology for wireless LANs is the IEEE 802.11, and it works in an unlicensed portion of the radio spectrum, and sort of, again, depending on flavors, it works in different places in that. It's standardized through IEEE, and then the Wi-Fi Alliance is an industry organization which polices the compliance to that standard and sort of attempts to sort of aid in interoperability and compatibility. Okay, and so again, this is the frequency band in which it operates is obviously significant. A significant distinction from, again, the cellular networks, which are all licensed and sort of forced to. So obviously that limits who operates in that range to whoever has a license. Here we're using the ISM, which is Industrial, Scientific, and Medical band, which is not licensed. Okay, so that means that anybody who has the technology can set it up and run it. And again, that makes sense since we're talking about such limited range, licenses would have to be pinned sort of to location as well as the frequency band, and it just would be unworkable. Okay. What exactly this band is differs from country to country. Although this 2.4 gigahertz band is, I think, fairly common to all the countries. Okay. And there are regulations limiting the transmit power, again, just so that you can limit the range and limit the interference. Okay, so this band is unlicensed, so it's used by a number of technologies. So you have 802.11, Bluetooth, cordless phones, and various proprietary standards. Microwave ovens actually emit frequencies in that spectrum as well, and particularly can interfere with Bluetooth operation. Okay. So essentially you're just hoping for the best when it comes to interference and hoping that not too many people set up in the same area. Okay. So there are, well, it's envisaged that there would be sort of two basic flavors of LAN. The first is sort of what we've, you know, come to sort of know, which is the infrastructure-based services set, and based services set is just defines the stations that are communicating and forming your local area network. Okay. And so in the infrastructure BSS, what you have is your typical access point. So the goal is to communicate out to the internet. Okay, so not necessarily to be talking amongst yourselves, just, you know, to get external access. All access then is regulated by the, or happens through the access point. Okay, so all communication is to and from that access point. It's also possible to set up an ad hoc network, so any pair of stations then, or any pair of devices, can talk to each other without going through this access point. And so that's called an independent BSS. And again, represents sort of a unit of communication, that's sort of a single network. Okay. So your BSS is going to have a limited range and potentially sort of like local other forms of local area networks, you want to have sort of a logical entity, so one logical network that extends over a greater range than can be covered by one BSS, and so you're able to connect up a number of wireless LANs using some sort of bridge to form a sort of a larger wireless LAN. Okay, and that's referred to as an extended services set. Okay, and in this case, again, you'd have access, you'd have the access point, you'd have to have an access point, and all of the access points would have the, it would advertise the same network ID, and you can join a user would connect to sort of the closest access point. Okay, and then, again, packets are forwarded then along a backbone network. Okay. Now, 802.11 is essentially yet another flavor of local area network covered by the IEEE 802 standard. So IEEE 802 typically covers, again, all the pretty much all the common flavors of local and metropolitan area networks. So point-to-point networking. Okay, so other examples are Ethernet, token rings, token buses, all those things, again, you might have seen in a basic networking course. Okay. Now, typically, what any of these 802 specifications do is the specifications are usually divided up, again, according to type of network, the flavor of network, and then specify the physical layer, a medium access control layer, so how do you share the medium, and then a logical link control layer. And in 802, typically there's a common LLC, the 802.2, covered by the 802.2 standard. Okay. So for 802.11 specifically, there are going to be a number of flavors, a number of different physical layers are defined. Each of these has found its way into a different portion of the standard denoted by different letters. And again, they each define a slightly different physical layer. So you have spread spectrum, you have orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, or you have MIMO techniques used. Okay. The medium access control is contention-based, typically. It is possible, the standard defines a controlled a medium access that's controlled by the access point, but typically that's not implemented. So typically it's a contention-based service, so it's like CSMA for the Ethernet standard. Okay. So, again, the point's arisen that we actually have sort of, even within 802.11, we have all these flavors, and each flavor is distinguished as an amendment, which gets a letter. So you get 802.11a, b, g, n, those would define the PHY layer, essentially, and others as well. Okay, and the lettering is done sort of as the working group is established, so as they sort of think about it and decide to produce a flavor of the standards, you get a letter, a new letter. Okay. And the amendments can apply to sort of any or all portions of the basic standard and can sort of work together as well. So again, 802.11 B, G, A, and N are phi/max standards, and they essentially define different phi components and how they're handled to provide medium access. Obviously, if you have OFDM, it's slightly different than frequency hopping, etc. Excuse me. Other amendments deal with sort of other sort of specific issues within the network. So 802.11e, for instance, provides quality of service handling. We'll say a few words about that at the end. F defines communication between access points. S is for mesh networking, so again, turning the thing into multi-hop networks. K is radio resource management, so it allows you to sort of pass various statistics about radio links to portions of the network. Okay. So, exactly how do we define the network? Well, if you were in the wired scenario, you'd have the wires and you'd have sockets and you'd just essentially plug in. And you'd have, once you plugged in, that would be your signal that you intended to join, and there would be some protocol to allow you to join the network. Okay, obviously this has to be moved to wireless signaling for 802.11. And so typically what happens is that your access point transmits periodically a beacon frame, which essentially just advertises the existence of the network to the surrounding area. Okay. And so, typically what happens is there's a number of channels that are set aside for connections, and the access point will cycle through these channels sending this beacon frame. Now the user station has two possibilities. They can listen on these channels to listen for the beacon frame, or they can take a more proactive approach and actually send out a probe to see if there's an access point available. In that case, the access point will respond directly. Okay. Once you've found an access point, then you have to, again, establish your right to be on the network. And again, this may be trivial, or there may actually be sort of some authentication involved, and then sort of perform handshaking and actually set up an association or a connection. Okay. So because of the sort of additional loss involved in the radio environment, all 802.11 frames have to be acknowledged, and if you if they aren't, you assume that the frame is lost. And typically a lost frame that will be resent. Okay. Now, for medium access control, as I said before, there are two primary modes are defined. Distributed coordination function, and this is a contention-based access, uses carrier-sense multiple access with collision avoidance, which is sort of the wireless flavor of CSMA-CD. So you transmit your frames, then you listen to see if they sort of, if there's a collision. If there is, you perform back off, and at some random time in the future, you retransmit. Okay. And again, this corresponds fairly well to the Ethernet protocol. Okay. The other option is the point coordination function, and here the access point controls your medium access, so it tells each of the users when they can transmit in a polling fashion, and the advantage of this is that it's contention free, but it tends not to be widely implemented. And finally, there's a hybrid coordination function which has sort of alternates between contention-based and contention-free transmission. Well, obviously, if you haven't implemented your point coordination function, you can't implement your hybrid coordination function either. But it is one of the proposals for QoS provision, quality of service provision, within 802.11. So obviously, it's a lot easier to provide quality of service if you have control over the resource allocation. And it's difficult, although we'll see, not impossible, to provide quality of service if you have less control over the resource allocation. Okay, so we have this contention-based medium access, and so what we want to do, obviously, is to try and minimize the number of collisions we have. And so in order to do that, the first thing you do is you listen, you sense the channel, and if the channel, you wait a period before you start transmitting. Okay. If collisions do occur, then again, you have to go into back off mode. Okay. Now, this is made more difficult in the wireless scenario in the sense that not all stations can hear all transmissions associated with the network. Okay. So if you look at this scenario here, node 1 and node 3 have an overlapping coverage area, but they also have portions that are non-overlapping. Okay. So node 1 would not know if node 3 was transmitting, and node 3 would not know if node 1 was transmitting. Okay. So even if they're listening to the medium, they might not hear what's going on. So if node 3 is sending to node 2, then node 1 can listen away, but it's not going to hear anything. And you know, therefore, if it starts transmitting, there's a problem. Okay. That's the hidden node problem. There's also an exposed node problem, which is sort of the reverse, which is that you can also make this sort of non-overlapping area of coverage work to your advantage and potentially set up more connections than you can potentially have more than one connection within the network at the same time. And so in this case, we can think of node 1 transmitting. To node 2, and then perhaps node 2 wants to transmit something to node 3. Okay, so that would actually not be a problem because the transmission from node 1 would not interfere with anything received by node 3. Okay. However, node 2 is going to listen to the medium and conclude that it's busy with its connection and not connect, or not try to do a separate connection. Okay. And so this is what would happen again in the wired equivalent, but it is possible we could have, again, made those two connections and sort of increased the network efficiency. Okay. So the MACA protocol is proposed to deal with that problem, and it uses two signaling packets, the request to send and the clear to send, and depending on which of those packets the stations hear, they can make conclusions about the exact nature of the connection that's being established and what will interfere with it and what won't. Okay. So I'm actually going to skip this and go into a slightly more detailed example to see how that works. This covers this example, and this is not in your notes, but I'll post an updated version. This shows how the request to send and the clear to send work for both the hidden station and the exposed station problem. Okay, so we have, in this example, our first instance, A wants to send to B, and so A doesn't just start sending its packets, it sends a request to send frame, and part of that is the duration of its transmission, so how long it's going to take to send. Okay. And so then B sends a clear to send message back saying that, okay, you're clear to send. Now, what's important about this is not how A and B interpret the messages, but how the other nodes in the area interpret the messages. So we have, in this case, three additional nodes, C, E, and D, and they're all going to hear slightly different things. C is going to hear the request to send, but not the clear to send. E is going to hear both the request to send and the clear to send, and D is only going to hear the clear to send. Excuse me. Okay. So when C hears the request to send, it's going to wait to listen for a clear to send. If it can't hear the clear to send, then it assumes that the receiver is out of its range, and therefore if it wants to transmit to somebody else, it's still free to do so. D hears the request to send, so it knows it's in the range, so it's going to be... D hears the clear to send, and knows that it's in the range of the receiving node, and therefore is not going to transmit. And again, it knows how long it needs to hold off on the transmission, because that information is in the clear to send packet. And finally, E hears everything, so it holds off on transmission. Okay. So, in that way, it's possible, again, to deal with these hidden node and exposed node problems and sort of refine your transmission. This is not necessarily implemented because, again, it adds overhead, but when you go to do your network simulation, this is part of the simulation you do, and part of what you're doing is sort of tracing through all those packets and seeing what happens. Okay. The network allocation vector, again, is designed to track or predict how much time that the medium is going to be busy. So even if you don't hear the actual transmission, you've gotten the information about the duration from the clear to send packet. And so the network allocation vector just tells you how long you're going to have to wait to start transmitting. Okay. And after the end of the transmission, so you know the time of the end of transmission, and after that you'll go into the attempt to sense the medium, so you'll still wait for a period of time to see if any other traffic comes on the medium. And you see there's sort of two different times, there's SIFs and DIFs, but we'll get into that later. Okay, later being this slide. Okay, so at the moment, what we've had is just all traffic is equal. You wait for a period of time to sense the medium, and then you sort of jump in if it's free. In actuality, 802.11 attempts to provide some form of prioritization by changing the amount of time that different types of packets sense the medium. Okay. So your high priority packets would be things like request to send, clear to send, acknowledgments, sort of the control information. And then there's sort of lower priority data and sort of network management type things. Okay. And so the idea is the higher the priority, the shorter that listening time ought to be. Okay. So if you have one packet that's waiting one time and another packet's waiting twice that amount of time, which one's going to get access to the medium? The one that's waiting, listening for the shorter amount of time. And so four different types of interframe spacing are defined, SIFS, DIFS, PIFS, and extended IFS. And these all correspond, again, to the priority of the packet, the relative importance of the packet, and allowing the more important packets to get through first. Okay. And again, this is what we see here is that, again, we have this, we always weight the IFS, and again, the shorter that IFS is, the less time you have to wait, and again, you can get into in before packets that have to wait longer amounts of time. Okay, and assuming that you have had a collision, then you go into a contention period, and there is a certain number of time slots, which is, again, going to be defined by the number of collisions you've had to date. And so each station will, when you're in a contention period, each station will sort of randomly transmit during one of those time slots. Again, listening while they do, before they do. Okay. So, the size of the contention window increases roughly exponentially depending on the number of collisions until reaching its maximum size of 1,024 time slots. And so again, the bigger your contention window, hopefully sort of the less chance of collision you get. Okay, so this is standard binary exponential backoff with some limits on sort of the exponent, essentially. Okay. So that's sort of the basics of the medium access control. The frame formatting is fairly straightforward. Again, if you've seen, to some extent, if you've seen one frame format, you've seen them all. It contains the information that's needed to to sort of perform all of these issues, and this is addressing information. Somewhere you'll see somewhere in there is error correction, etc. And so we'll just run quickly through the various fields. It doesn't add a huge amount of overhead. It's 34 bytes out of sort of a payload of up to several thousand bytes. Okay. So the frame control gives information about what version of 802.11 you're using. The type of frame it is, so is it a control frame, is it a data frame? Within that, a subtype, so if you have a control frame, you've got you serve a number of possibilities. You might be sending a beacon message. An indication of whether the frame is coming in from the outside world or going out to the outside world. Indication of whether the frame has been fragmented. Is this a retransmission? Power information. So there's some power management within 802.11. An indication to a station that there's data available for it. Security, ordering, etc. Okay. The duration, again, gives sort of the duration of the transmission to sort of aid in the medium access control. And there are four addresses now. And these addresses indicate not only the source and destination node, but also the access points associated with that node. Okay, so again, the communication is going through access points, and so those have to be indicated as well. Okay, then you have your payload. And a bit more control information. So sequence control, this is used for your ARQ formats. And excuse me, error checking. So you typically uses a cyclical redundancy code. So again, this is quite similar to the frame formatting that you'd get for other LAN configurations as well, with, again, a bit more control added on for the sort of radio aspects of the problem, and again, this additional addressing, which you wouldn't necessarily see before. Okay. And so your frames then are divided up according to purpose. You've got control frames, which, again, are sort of trying to regulate access to the medium. Data frames, whose primary purpose is to transmit data, but essentially, control information can be piggybacked onto data frames as well, in particular the acknowledgement type information. And network management frames, which deal with joining and leaving the network. Okay. So again, this slide is somewhat relevant to your assignment. Why do you get lower throughput than advertised? And the answer is that the throughput is essentially raw data rates. And you have two additional issues. One is that you have overhead, so you have header information. And the second is error control. So a single piece of information potentially is transmitted more than one time. Okay, so all of that adds up to reducing the actual amount of data sort of an end user would see. Okay, I think we're almost... Okay, now I'm not going to say a whole lot about security, but that again, it exists. It is sort of again part of the protocol again because you know in a wireless environment you have to have some way of protecting your data. And the original security protocol was the Wired Equivalency Protocol, WEP, which relies on authentication and then encryption of your data. And the WEP is no longer, and this is actually what is discussed in Stallings, but WEP is no longer used just because the encryption protocols were not sort of sufficiently robust. Excuse me. The current security protocol is WPA2, Wireless Protected Access, version 2. And this was developed as part of the 802.11i standard, and again uses more robust encryption protocols. Okay, so we won't say a whole lot about the physical layer. That, again, it's divided into two portions. The lower layer is responsible for the actual physical transmission of bits. And again, it varies depending on sort of the flavor of 802.11. And then the physical layer convergence procedure is essentially just an interface between the medium access and the actual physical transmission of bits, which is appropriate to essentially the modulation technique you're using. Okay. Typically, just if you're using 802.11b or g, you don't have an infinite, or you don't have, you can't use all of the channels in a non-overlapping fashion. And typically you only get three non-overlapping channels. Okay, and so to sort of counteract that and try and get a little more out of your network, usually some form of spread spectrum is used. Okay, so that sort of gets over the non-overlapping issue. Okay. N is sort of the most recent PHY specification, and it increases the channel bandwidth. And sort of, again, uses advanced antenna technology to try and sort of sort out various interference problems. The final thing that I'll mention, again, is just to return to the issue of quality of service, which, again, is in the wireless domain, it's difficult to deal with since the resources are limited. There are two proposals for the provision of quality of service. The one is the hybrid control function, which again is not typically implemented. The other is enhanced distributed channel access, which is implemented to some extent. And EDCA distinguishes between different traffic classes and gives higher priority to sort of traffic with higher quality of service requirements. Okay, so it has a number of mechanisms then to try and favor the high priority traffic. Traffic, sort of at the node, traffic is split into four different classes, a couple of best effort classes, a voice class, and a video class. And sort of the node itself will sort out its traffic priorities. So it will give, it will seek to transmit the highest priority packets that it has available. Okay. Then they do go back into a contention-based medium. But, like we saw before, interframe spacing is used to give priority to the voice and video traffic classes. Okay, so they will listen for a shorter time than will the best effort classes. Okay, and finally, in addition to that, for each class you have defined a transmission opportunity, which is a period of time where once that traffic class has access to the medium, it can transmit multiple frames up to a certain maximum transmission time. So you can get a little bit more data out per each contention period. Okay, so we'll take a short... Okay, we'll get started again. And so our second network technology today is Bluetooth, which, like the wireless LAN, is trying to provide point-to-point connectivity. Unlike wireless LAN, it's sort of trying to do this for loads of different reasons. Again, LANs are just trying to transmit data packets. Bluetooth, you might want to connect into different networks. You might want to sort of connect devices for just transmitting data. You might just want to get rid of a few wires. There's a number of reasons or functions that you might use Bluetooth for. And so the protocol is, it's sort of a little bit more messy just because it's trying to, again, do all things for all people. Okay, again, William Stallings, Chapter 15, covers this, or the Payload Wireless tutorial is also pretty readable. Okay, so like 802.11, Bluetooth is designed to provide short-range wireless connections and is using the unlicensed band, in this case the 2.4 gigahertz band again, which is typically available everywhere. Okay. And in terms of connectivity, devices within 10 meters can typically share up to 720 kilobits per second of data. Okay, and it supports a lot of different applications. And it arose from industry. It was sort of pioneered by Ericsson, and then sort of after the fact was standardized. Okay. And, yeah, since then, the 802.15 standards have diverged again from Bluetooth. Okay. And it's developed and licensed by the Bluetooth Special Interest Group. Now, Bluetooth, again, is trying to provide wireless connectivity for a whole range of different end purposes. Okay. And so the application areas that are proposed are as a data and voice access point, so being able to transmit voice data or data either between two Bluetooth devices or, again, out into the wider network. As straight cable replacement, so just to eliminate the need for to plug in a cable. Yeah, so if you want to hook up to your printer or whatever, you can do it via Bluetooth instead of having to plug in. And ad hoc networking, so again, allowing a number of devices to sort of communicate however they want. And yeah, typically if you're say laptop is Bluetooth enabled, you'll see these messages popping up about what other devices they've detected that you can connect up with. Okay. And so typically Bluetooth, it bounces between sort of these usage scenarios and then sort of a number of protocol elements that can be combined in different ways to support these scenarios. So typical things are, again, like a 3-in-1 phone. You could just use your phone in different modes. In some cases, you can use it as an intercom, so just have two phones. If you're like in an office scenario and you're close to your colleagues, you can just communicate directly. At home, you can use the same device to function as a cordless phone, so then it has to connect up to the POTS, the telephony network. Or then you can use it as a mobile phone and connect up to a cellular network. Okay, and yeah, you can just keep going through. And you see that each of these serve it, they fall into one of these three areas. That's sort of a voice communications. Cordless desktop is this idea of cable replacement. Automatic synchronization is almost an ad hoc thing. It's two devices sort of talking to each other to exchange data. Okay. So again, there's sort of a lot of different things that Bluetooth wants to support. And so to do this, it has a sort of a core specification, which defines a layered architecture with a number of protocols in it. Some of those protocols are unique to Bluetooth. Some of them are sort of borrowed from other protocol stacks, and again, just so you can get sort of an application-level integration. Okay. And then within the protocols defined in this stack, you have profile specifications, which essentially detail how you can combine some subset of the protocols to provide a specific service to the user. So the protocols you use to replace a cable to sort of talk to your printer are not quite the same ones that you would use to, again, perform a voice conversation or to transmit data from one device to another. And so the profile service connected to a usage model that says, you know, what you hope to achieve, and then indicates which portions of the protocol protocol stack have to be there, may or may not be there, or don't apply. Okay. And I should also mention that it's about 1,500 pages of specification, so it's not a short, sweet specification. It's pretty painful to go through. Okay, so here we see the protocol stack. And again, the lowest layer is a radio layer, so radio communications. Your baseband layer provides your medium access control. Your link management layer provides just that, your point-to-point link management. And then your logical link control and adaptation protocol is, again, the interface between this link and the various types of applications that you're trying to perform. And those are all core to the Bluetooth specification. So those all, they're core in the sense that they're always present, and they're specific to Bluetooth. Okay. And then finally, you have SDP, I'm trying to remember what the stands for, but it is a protocol that searches for other Bluetooth-enabled devices and tries to find what services are being offered by various Bluetooth devices. It's service discovery protocol. Okay, so those always sort of are in effect. And then various other protocols, come into effect depending on what sort of application you're using. Okay, and we see that certain of them are for cable replacement, like RFCOM is a cable replacement protocol, and so allows you to sort of emulate the way data would come off a cable, so in a serial fashion. Okay. The AT commands and the TCS bin are telephony control protocols, so would come into play when you were trying to sort of emulate telephony type in data. And other protocols, again, are borrowed from various other portions of the protocol stack. So obviously, the WAE, WAP, UDP, TCP, IP point-to-point protocol is sort of connecting you to the internet. Audio allows you to pick your audio allows you to pick how your voice signal is encoded, and the OBEX is, or object exchange, allows you to sort of send information about the type of binary data you're transmitting. Okay. So this just, these next few slides just summarize that. Okay. And again, what we see is that we have usage models and profiles associated with these usage models, which essentially select the protocols that are needed to provide a specific service. So, for instance, if you want to do a file transfer, you need to, again, have your cable replacement. You need to have your object exchange to tell you the characteristics of the file you're trying to transfer. And then you pass that on to some sort of file transfer application. Okay. If you have a modem, then again, you've got your cable replacement, and then you sort of are connecting to, you're using your telephony control to connect, and then you have a modem emulator application. Okay. And so it goes. Okay. So again, for each different application, you have sort of a different set of protocols coming into play, and that's all specified. Okay. So, how are those connections made, or what do they look like? Well, the basic unit of Bluetooth networking is the PicoNet, and it sort of sets up how sort of networking and how connectivity is achieved via Bluetooth. And it's a master-slave configuration. And what that means is that you have one device controlling the network. Okay. So, in contrast to 802.11, nobody was really in charge. So, when you wanted medium access, for instance, you had to contend for it. Here, the master is in charge. The master determines access and what goes on the network. Okay. The master is connected to up to 7 slave devices. It's possible to have more connections that are in park mode, so that aren't actually sort of active at any time, but there can be 7 active connections at any given time. The master determines the channel access and the timing offset, so the time at which the slaves will transmit, and the slaves only, all communication occurs through the master. Okay. Now, it's possible to sort of build that up into bigger networks, and you can have scatter nets where devices in one PicoNet are also attached or associated with a second PicoNet or more. Okay, so the contrast you have is, you have cellular systems where, again, everything goes through the base stations and everything's neatly divided up. You have your wireless LAN type setup where sort of there isn't this concept of overlapping, and then you have the Bluetooth idea where, you have these basic networks, but then they can overlap and interact with each other. Okay. So the radio specification, there's two main, three main things, It defines the modulation technique, so you use Gaussian frequency shift key modulation, and then it has some power control. Excuse me. Okay. The baseband then regulates access to the medium. Okay. And it subdivides the channels up according to frequency and time, and then provides for frequency hopping over the channels. And so the way it does that is the total bandwidth is divided into 1 megahertz physical channels, and typically we can have 79 of these, and then you have each PicoNet has a hopping sequence. Okay. And so communication sort of alternates between the master and the slave. So the time is broken up into time slots, and then the master will transmit on one time slot, and then the slave responds on the next. Okay. Okay. And so the hopping occurs on a per time slot basis. So each time slot, the carrier frequency changes. Okay. It's possible to transmit for more than one time slot. In multi-slot mode, so any packet can transmit for 1, 3, or 5 time slots, and during the transmission, no hopping occurs. And so essentially the hop sequence is ignored for the duration of the transmission. Okay. And then it resumes after the transmission. Okay. Now again, in the spirit of trying to provide sort of different things to different applications, the medium access control distinguishes or offers two different sorts of services. It offers a synchronous connection-oriented service, which is going to allocate fixed bandwidth between the master and the slave, and essentially maintains a link for the duration of a transmission. And so what this gives you is a guaranteed rate, a data rate. It doesn't guarantee necessarily correctness at this level. So if your packet's lost, obviously, sort of any retransmission or whatever is going to decrease that data rate. Okay. And it's also possible to have an asynchronous connectionless mode, so packet transmission essentially. And in that case, you don't sort of guarantee any bandwidth, but it's sort of allocated on as needed basis. Okay. And typically, you end up with error corrections as you would have for any local area network. So you'll have data, packet retransmission, etc. Okay. So there are three error correction schemes available, and again, what error correction scheme you use is going to depend on what your end application is. I realized when I was reading the slide this morning that I had sort of dropped all the bit about sort of framing and types of packets, so you've got all these types of packets listed, and sort of no introduction to that. But basically, DM is data packets, HV is voice packets, DV is data and voice, and FHS is control, so frequency hopping control. Okay, and so depending on what type of packet you have, which is, again, what sort of connection, it's governed by what sort of connection you've set up, you use different forms of error correction. Your strongest form of error correction is the 1/3 rate FEC, so forward error correction. And this sends three copies of every bit and uses a majority rule to determine the correct bits. And this is used for voice packet transmission. So, there's enough bandwidth to allow it, and you don't have time for essentially retransmissions when you're talking about voice. Okay, so 2/3 rate error correction is, it's essentially a form of parity checking, and it'll correct single errors and detect double errors, but won't correct them. And then finally, ARQ, automatic request repeat, is sort of error detection with packet retransmission. Okay. And this is used with your data packets primarily, and sort of some important voice packets or voice control packets. Okay. The ARQ scheme that is used in Bluetooth is referred to as a fast ARQ scheme because, again, it depends on this alternation between master and slave transmission. And because you're alternating, you can send your negative acknowledgments in essentially the next time slot, and therefore they can be responded to within one time, or sort of within one logical time slot. Okay, so we see this here. We have a master communicating with several slaves, and so the second packet that the master tries to transmit to slave one fails. The slave can immediately send a negative acknowledgement, and the master can immediately resend that packet. If we look at slave 2 now, again, it tries to send a packet to the master, which fails. The master sends the negative acknowledgement in its next communication with that slave, so not the next time slot, but the next time slot, which is communicating to the second slave, and then the slave can again respond to that and immediately retransmit. Okay. So it all boils down to the way that the communication is set up, where the master and slave have these sort of pairs that you send data and then you send in one direction, then immediately in the other direction. Okay. This might not happen if you're sharing the medium with more than one connection, then this isn't going to happen at every two time slots, but whenever it happens, it goes in both ways. Okay. The channels are divided into logical channels, which again carry different sorts of traffic and then have to be mapped back onto the physical channels. Okay, so various control functions are divided into different logical channels, and data transmission is yet another logical channel, and then that gets mapped onto physical channels. Okay. And so, finally, the baseband is responsible for sort of setting up the connections between the master and the slave. And so there are two primary states. You can either be in standby or connect or have an active connection. And then there are a number of interim states for setting up that connection. Okay. So if we the easiest thing to do is just look at a couple of scenarios. So a typical procedure is an inquiry procedure, and here the master is sort of looking for devices that want to participate in a connection, so it's looking for slaves to connect to. And so to do this, the master is going to broadcast an ID packet over 32 specific 32 of the 79 channels, which are sort of set aside for that purpose, at least sort of initially set aside for that purpose. So the master transmits this IAC over these 32 channels in turn. And at this point, the master is in the inquiry state, so it hasn't set up the connections yet. Okay. Now, the devices, which are sort of on and Bluetooth enabled, are going to switch between standby and inquiry scan, so they're going to essentially sleep for a while, and then they're going to look around and see if there's anything out there. And so the device, while it's in the inquiry scan state, will receive the message from the master, and it can then respond to that master. And indicates sort of its address and its the information the master will need for connectivity, And then it moves, it waits for a page from the master. Okay. So, it goes from inquiry scan to inquiry response, back to, then to page scan. Okay. Now, if you have a collision, then it goes back to its inquiry scan mode. Okay. And so then the paging procedure moves on to setting up the actual connection between the master and the slave. Okay, and it's essentially just a bunch of handshaking that goes on to get everybody onto a correct, you know, to get sort of resources allocated and the connection made. And the master has to do that with each individual device in turn. So each slave will move into the connection state as its sort of handshaking with the master concludes. The master moves into the connection state when all of the connections between various slaves are enabled. Okay. And so that essentially sets up your Bluetooth network with a master and a number of slaves. Okay, and then the slave, when it's connected to the network, it can be in one of four modes. It can be active, so it can participate in sort of transmitting and receiving data. It can be in sniff mode, where it's listening to specific slots but not transmitting. Hold, where it's sort of idle until it's needs not to be. And park, where it's connected but not actively participating. Okay. The audio, so the voice encoding scheme is also part of the baseband specification. And the two schemes that are available are straight PCM or continuous CVSD. So again, that's, you say, up or down by sort of a varying amount. Okay. And what you actually use is, again, going to be negotiated by the link manager. So that's part of the link management protocol, but the schemes themselves are offered within this layer. Okay. So, link management is sort of responsible for setting up the and managing the connection. And so in addition to just sort of, again, the physical details, it's encryption, all the security is handled at this level. So again, encryption and authentication as it is used. Okay, the messages are exchanged as protocol data units. And again, these are just sort of the different messages handling various management issues. Okay, and those include security, timing and synchronization, station capability, mode control. Sort of again, setting up exactly how the what the connection should look like. Okay, so the LMP sort of specifies what the connection should look like, and then the baseband layer actually is responsible for making that connection. Okay. L2CAP then is roughly corresponds to the logical link control layer. So it's what's responsible for providing sort of an error-free service, or as much of an error-free service as is desired. And again, at this layer, we distinguish between a connectionless service, so providing datagram services, and a connection-oriented service, which will provide flow control and error control. Okay. And for a connectionless service, again, each channel is sort of regarded as individual and unidirectional, and this can be used to broadcast from a master to a number of slaves. For connection-oriented services, again, you're setting up a two-way connection now, and additionally, you can specify your quality of service parameters. Okay, so again, you can request certain data rates, quality to your data transfer. Okay, and again, since the master controls the allocations, all of this can be negotiated. And signaling is just, you know, again, to provide control. Okay. And so the signaling commands are to set up and sort of configure the setup. Okay. So, we won't say a lot about quality of service, except again that you can request essentially various characteristics. The main thing you can request is sort of a raw bit rate. You can also make requests in terms of delay. And just to wrap up this section, and on the dot of noon, I'll just mention IEEE 802.15, which sort of it moves along somewhat in parallel to Bluetooth. What essentially happened was sort of Bluetooth started, IEEE made some attempt at sort of bringing it into the standards fold, and they've actually diverged again. So the 802.15.1 and it should be 802.15.1 2005 are based on the Bluetooth standards, but what's actually used are the actual Bluetooth standards, not the IEEE versions. Okay. The 802.15 standard has then branched out into various other wireless personal area network solutions, so other ways of, again, providing relatively short-range connectivity, including probably one of the more common ones now would be Zigbee, and yeah, they're still working on a bunch of different standards. So that's all I'm going to say about Bluetooth. We will wrap up next week with a discussion of WiMAX, and then a few words about the exam and what you can expect on the exam. So again, Martin should be waiting for you over in the lab if you have any questions. And otherwise, you know, again, if you're remote, or even if you're here and questions arise, just try and email him, and you know, he'll sort you out as best he can.